Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 9th of February, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted to say that we've got Vanessa Beely joining us for some comment on matters to do with Syria. Weather pretty good here in Plymouth. We're happy at that.
Right. We'll start off with Ukraine. Kiev is fueling the war in eastern Ukraine too. So this is quite an interesting article from Foreign Policy magazine because they wouldn't normally recognize such things. Foreign Policy magazine, is the article's by Isaac Webb. He is a freelance writer. That is the key point. He says there's no evidence that regular Russian troops are involved in the current fighting. And, of course, he's talking about the fact that that fighting has broken out again in eastern Ukraine. As we predicted, I believe, between us all, we did say that the front would move. Now that Syria, as far as the West is concerned, is effectively a lost cause.
Now, Syria is a lost cause.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're heading back to Ukraine to stoke things up there. Here's the Ukrainian prime minister who is saying that basically it would be costly if Trump, for example, were to sort of be a bit friendly to Vladimir Putin. He's saying that the shelling in eastern Ukraine is massive. He said, who would dare talk about lifting the sanctions in such circumstances? He's talking about Grad rocket launchers being used against the civilian population. The language is very similar to the type of language that has been used in Syria over the years. But basically, we've got to make sure the sanctions aren't lifted against Putin. Now, yesterday, speaking to TASS, Sergei Lavrov said that if someone hopes that all Ukraine's problems will be solved as soon as Kiev regains control of Donbass, they're wrong, that's impossible. This continues to be stoked up. And by whom is the question? Now, last year, Oliver Stone produced a documentary, at least he co-produced a documentary called Ukraine on Fire. And it basically tore strips off the official narrative that Russia is the problem in the Ukraine. And so he was then speaking to Russia's Channel One yesterday or the day before, and he said, if I were President Trump, I would declassify all the information on Ukraine as well as Syria, but above all on Ukraine, because it's the focal point of where the Cold War has come about. So he's talking about a new Cold War. And he said that Ukraine was one of the main objectives of the CIA. He said that that's been the case since the start of the Cold War, and that the US is providing aid to militia and dissident groups since the late 1940s. And of course, he's pointing out that that it's effectively been a color revolution and so on. And he said that, the Ukrainian authorities are now going to be looking to Trump to provide them with financial and other assistance. Well, actually, perhaps they're not going to be looking to Donald Trump, because, in fact, the Ukrainian prime minister is in Brussels today to meet with the European Union and also with NATO. So this is Prime Minister Groysman, and he's holding meetings with the Deputy Secretary General of NATO and also with Donald Tusk, the President of the European Council today. So I guess he's begging for support there. But Vanessa, I know this is not really, Ukraine isn't really your subject, but there is no question that there are many parallels to be drawn between Ukraine and Syria.
Yeah, absolutely, and perfectly, in the sense that it was effectively an intervention, another illegal intervention, another illegal regime change. And the people in the east of Ukraine, of course, are being effectively massacred and ignored. I was speaking to various friends who have friends in the east and who were describing the heavy shelling, the use of very heavy duty missiles against civilians in that area. And of course, that's being completely blacked out. I asked someone actually 2 days ago if any mainstream media were going into the east, and they said, no, of course not. They're all reporting as, again, from Kiev, from the imposed regime side. So again, we're seeing a complete bias in the mainstream media complete blackout, apart from RT again. I noticed they did a very good report on East Ukraine a couple of days ago. So, yes, in that, the parallels are very distinct and very noticeable.
And I suppose the other parallel that we could mention is the activities of NGOs and think tanks in this. So the Ukrainian Prime Minister is going to take part tomorrow in a what's being described as an international conference. It's entitled Promotion and Direction, Reboot of Ukrainian Reforms, and it's being organised by the Wilfrid Martin Centre for European Studies. So we keep seeing these types of organisations getting involved in things they shouldn't be getting involved in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the soft power complex, or the smart power, whatever you want to call it, weaponization of humanitarianism. And we see it globally. The infiltration by the NGOs, by the think tanks, as the soft power vanguard, if you like, of the intervention apparatus, which of course effectively supports the military industrial complex.
I'll just add in, I think we also ought to include the United Nations, because of course if you have a look at United Nations policy, one of the big things they're doing at the moment is telling us that terrorism is worldwide scourge, and therefore it's up to the United Nations to bring countries together to fight this terrorism. And that's a key start of the policy, and particularly through the NGOs that Mike's just mentioned. So I no longer believe that the UN is there for the benefit of mankind. I think it's there to help bring in the one world system of government. And what better way to do it than constant war and these claims of terrorist activities in order to herd people into one group that can be controlled.
Yeah.
And the other point I'd just like to make is I smile when I see people apparently meeting with both NATO and the European Union with respect to military terms, because at the end of the day, major operations with NATO require a huge amount of planning, because you can't get all of these different nations to work together very easily. Some are more capable than others. Some have better communications than others. So to have that set of problems and alongside it a similar set of problems through the United Nations, utter chaos, but the sort of chaos, of course, that the political agenda can be drifted through without people realise what's really going on.
Indeed. Right. Well, look, let's move on to fake news. And this is a spectacular example from The Economist. An insurgent in the White House is how it's being described. Donald Trump standing there with a red, or the image is of Donald Trump standing with a red baseball cap and a petrol bomb in his hands.
This is outrageous. I don't know whether this is an actionable depiction of him, but it would be very interesting if he'd go for The Economist.
Right. So The Economist saying, as Donald Trump rages against the world he inherited as president, America's allies are worried, and rightly so. Well, indeed, because, of course, his allies or America's allies are the likes of Britain, France and so on that are blowing this planet
up. But he
up.
Didn't rage against the world.
No,
he hasn't
true.
Said anything against the world. In fact, he's made a series of very measured statements about how we would like relations to improve with key world states.
Right. They say the more Mr. Trump used his stump speeches to offend polite opinion, the more his supporters were convinced that he really would evict the treacherous, greedy elite from their Washington salons. His grenade chuckers-in-chief, Stephen Bannon and Stephen Miller, have now carried that logic into government. It's spectacular language and once again demonstrates the sheer desperation of these people. But Vanessa, let's come straight on to the big story that was breaking earlier in the week, which was Amnesty International's claims. Their headline is The Human Slaughterhouse, Mass Hangings and Extermination in Syrian Prison. Where do you want to start with this?
what we've actually seen, this actually broke yesterday across all the mainstream media. And of course, even though the Amnesty report in its note 40, which is in the small print of the report itself, it explains that the numbers are pure speculation. In other words, if A happened in X, then Y would be the number achieved. And the minimum to maximum was around 5,300 and something to just over the 13,000. And of course, the mainstream media have immediately run with the maximum figure, even though all of the numbers in the Amnesty report are pretty much hearsay and speculation. But let's look at the timing of the report, and I think this is very important. I noted this in an article that I produced yesterday. So it follows on immediately from the liberation of Aleppo and the driving out of the NATO and Gulf state and various other members of the US coalition, funded, backed, and supported terrorist and extremist factions led by Al-Qaeda and Nusra Front. It comes immediately after the Astana peace talks and the drafting by Russia proposal of the new Syrian constitution. It comes after the Russian and Turkish ceasefire was pretty successfully brokered and in place compared to the many US brokered ceasefires that, of course, fell through because their proxies on the ground didn't adhere to it. It also follows on from Tulsi Gabbard's fact-finding trip to Syria, which blew apart yet again the corporate media, the NGOs, the UN, and Western and Gulf regime propaganda, and of course her Stop Arming Terrorists bill, which has been going through with great success, or has a lot of support. It then also follows on from an uncertain Trump policy, which threatens to undermine American and UK deep state regime change objectives, supported of course by the EU, Gulf states, Israel, etc., Turkey. And then, of course, you also have, and I think this is critical, Syria's pivot towards Russia and China, towards the BRICS New Development Bank, for the reconstruction of Syria after the NATO and Gulf states have waged this filthy war against Syria for the last 6 years. And, of course, this is going to deprive the NATO states of their usual mop-up profit and private sector benefits that they rely upon when they create one of these sort of perpetual conflicts, as Brian just mentioned. That is the major benefit for them, along with the profit to the military-industrial complex. And then, of course, it's 2 weeks, just 2 weeks before the scheduled Geneva peace talks. So again, whenever one of these reports, particularly by Amnesty International, that is a recognized soft power propaganda tool of the United States State Department, I mean, it's a revolving door anyway between its employees and the United States State Department. That's also a known fact. If we look at one of the directors, Suzanne Nossel, I can't remember the exact date that she was director, but she came directly from the US State Department. So it's recognized as a soft power tool. It's recognized as having facilitated intervention in Libya, in Iraq, based on the fake incubator baby story that Amnesty International ran with, and therefore the mainstream media ran with, which we know facilitated genocide in Iraq and the starvation by sanctions of over 500,000 children in Iraq. So that is the background to the report. And I think that timing is incredibly important, even before we get on to completely debunking the report.
Right. Well, before we do that, let's have a look at least one example of disgraceful mainstream coverage of this. So here we've got CNN, 13,000 people hanged at secret Syrian prison, Amnesty says. And the first thing that CNN does is place the interview with Tulsi Gabbard right at the heart of that, right at this top of that article. So first of all, they are trying to brand Tulsi Gabbard as an apologist for 13,000 deaths. They're trying to tar her with this brush. This is at best disingenuous, but it is the worst kind of fake news.
Yeah, it's appalling. It's absolutely appalling. I noticed that when I opened that report this morning. It's extraordinary subliminal marketing of the message that they want to implant into public perception.
But that wasn't the only video they embedded in this story, because further down the page, they embedded an interview with three people that had been investigating what they were calling wrongdoing in Syria. This investigation led by Sir Des de Silva, the London firm of Carter Ruck, he had said had asked him to put a team together to investigate the reliability of the defector in Syria. And this is the defector known as Caesar, I think, and the Caesar report. But the point that you made to me earlier, Vanessa, is that this interview was done, 2 years ago? And they have put they have embedded this interview on the page describing the Amnesty International report. And the implication is that this is linked, and they certainly don't make it clear within the body of their article or in the caption for the video that it is not linked to the Amnesty.
No, it's very ambiguous how they describe it. I think I had another quick look at it. They do make some kind of differentiation, but it's very ambiguous. If somebody were to glance at that quickly, they would assume that that video is concerning the most recent claims by Amnesty International.
So I mean, you know, how do you describe that type of reporting? It is fake.
It's complete fake news. And from my marketing background, this is very clever. As I said, it's subliminal programming. It's gaslighting. It's implanting and imprinting a certain reality into people's perception and into people's minds. And it's reinforcing actually previous propaganda, the Caesar Report, which has been extensively debunked, particularly by Rick Sterling, who wrote, I think it was over a 30-page report, going through the Caesar Report section by section and debunking it completely. So if anyone wants to check up on that, just Google Rick Sterling Caesar Report and you'll come up with his full report debunking that. So it's reinforcing previous propaganda, and it's subliminally imprinting current propaganda into people's perceptions. It's clever.
Okay, now we have a little video clip. Just talk us through this while this is showing. But basically, this is an interview with somebody who's spent time in that prison.
Yeah, I mean, basically, Sadnaya, which is the prison that is described in the Amnesty International report, they describe these prisoners as civilian, non-military. Now, what this guy is actually saying, and you're right in saying, I believe that he was actually put into Sadnaya prison, is that the majority of these prisoners are actually extremist Islamists and terrorists. In other words, Al-Qaeda predominantly. I think he even makes the point that the majority are Al-Qaeda. Now, this was corroborated in August when I was in Damascus, and the initial very slick 3D video was released by Amnesty International around August the 16th, I think, from memory, which was their first attempt to put this report out into public, into the media. And actually, at the time, I spoke to various officials, including the Grand Mufti, and he said to me, look, the majority of the prisoners that are inside Sadnaya will have gone through a judicial process in Damascus before they are transferred to Sadnaya. But he said the majority of them are the most hardline, hardcore terrorists. Now, this is not mentioned in the Amnesty report, of course. Neither do they get any divergent views, i.e. from the Christian communities in the area of Sadnaya that have suffered tremendous atrocities at the hands of the very terrorists that are being incarcerated in Sadnaya prison. Nowhere does Amnesty get any feedback from the people of Mooloolah or the people of Sadnaya itself, who were besieged, kidnapped, executed, invaded, occupied during 2013-2014. So, you know, again, we have an Amnesty report that is based on spurious testimony of so-called Syrian dissidents outside Syria. They take no divergent views from people inside Syria. The numbers, the actual named numbers that Amnesty have in the report, they received themselves 95 names in total. They were given another 375 names by the Syrian Network for Human Rights, which, of course, if we look into them and 21st Century Wire has done previously, they're a coalition member of the Responsibility to Protect.org, which in turn is funded by the International Crisis Group, which obviously has as its members Soros Open Society Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. So, you know, nowhere can this evidence that Amnesty is producing can be considered either unbiased or impartial or neutral. And they don't balance the report, as I say, and that's a very important fact. So these numbers are based upon speculation, upon hearsay. Even Amnesty itself in the small print admits that the numbers are speculative.
Okay, and let's highlight this. Now, it's hard to read, but I do recommend people go and read it. This is from the Angry Arab blog, dated today, or yesterday, sorry, and discussing the amnesty report. So what are they saying here?
Well, I mean, this is very important. In fact, this document alone destroys the Amnesty International report, and I'll explain why, because the writer of the Angry Arab Blogspot is actually vehemently against the Syrian government, so he cannot be considered a partisan source. That's Assad Abu Khalil. Then if we look at the actual Syrian dissident who's in Europe, who has produced this damning evidence against the Amnesty International report, Kevork Almasyan, who runs Syriana Analysis, and I thoroughly recommend to the viewers to go and check out Syriana Analysis. They've also done a very good breakdown of the Amnesty International report. Kevork is based in Damascus. He's Syrian, so he knows what he's talking about. But he actually said to me, and I'm reading it, Nizar Nayud is a former prisoner. He hates Assad more than anything in the world. I used to follow his writings. Therefore, his testimony and explanation has huge value, and I doubt that Amnesty is going to be able to answer to Nayyub's notes. Now, just very quickly, if we just take one element of Nayyub's notes, he basically goes through the entire report and completely discredits it based on his own experience. So this is not coming from somebody that is outside Syria that's creating evidence along the lines of Amnesty's report, but he actually says, for example, on page 43, there is a copy of a certificate, a death certificate, which reveals that it belongs to the Minister of Interior. But the certificate says that the death was in military Tishrin Hospital, which belongs to the Ministry of Defense. This can't happen. In cases of death in a military hospital or in detention centers belonging to the Ministry of Intelligence, the certificates show Army or Armed Forces, Directorate of Military Medical Services, or Hospital X. So you can, just from that one statement, you can see how clearly he goes through each point and completely negates it. I mean, he basically, through most of his testimony, says this report is ridiculous. He even points out the fact that they claim that the bodies of those that were executed were dumped in what was already a graveyard for military martyrs inside Syria. And he said, actually, what is even more ridiculous about this piece of evidence is it damns Amnesty International because it actually shows the increase in the number of victims in the Syrian Arab Army. So it's well worth reading it. It's quite hard to go through it and sort of pick out the points, but it's definitely worth doing.
Okay, Vanessa, thank you very much for this.
You're
now
welcome.
We'll just end on this because you've pull this together into a summary article on 21st Century Wire, Amnesty International, Humanitarian Spin Merchants and Propaganda Peddlers. So we recommend that and suggest everybody goes and have a read of that.
Thank you. Yeah, I definitely do. And I'd like to say thanks to, you know, everyone, UK Column, to everyone out there who have been mentioned in that report. I think this has got to be record time that an Amnesty International report has been debunked and discredited. So great.
Okay. Thank you, Vanessa. Thank you.
All right.
Thank
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. While of course we've got Syria going on, we've got war in the Yemen. People are commenting on this, saying that the BBC at the moment continually describing that as a civil war. So there's no real mention of Saudi Arabia in it. But while we have all these overseas wars going on, of course, people are distracted from what is going on in UK. And we are seeing a rapid acceleration in the attack on our constitution. And of course, if we allow that to happen, we won't have a country to live in. So let's just have a look at some of the key areas. The first one is, of course, the juries have been completely trivialised and undermined. And the significance of this, at the end of the day, the jury should be the key body of justice in this country. And if we're accused of committing a crime, we should be brought in front of a jury of our peers. This is not happening. It's not happening in the family courts. It's not happening in courts of protection, where we simply have judges trying to act in place of a jury, and this is a significant breakdown of our rule of law. We've also got the increasing evidence of judges directing juries. Now, this is itself a criminal offence, but I have sat in one particular case in Portsmouth, which was astounding when the judge effectively gave the jury one document and said, perhaps you'd like to go outside and come back with the right decision. And there was only one decision inferred in his comments, and that was guilty, which the jury subsequently did. Why did the jury do this? Because they weren't aware of their rights. Common law is being usurped by the statute legal system. And we have direct attacks on our constitution, not least of which is the fact that many politicians are simply denying that we have a constitution in the first place. Coupled with this, the fake money supply, money created from nothing for the benefit of the international banks and not the nation. These components put together, we say, are the key attacks on our society and constitution. Now, I'm delighted to say that the Winchester Declaration, which has been sitting under the surface for a while since November last year, the British Constitution Group conference, that is now up and available on the website. There's a link at the top there, but encourage people to go and read that document, which we believe is basically a foundation stone to say what is wrong and what people need to do to reassert the rule of law in UK. And I'll also add that in doing that, we also believe and we are stating we can help people in other countries because, of course, unlawful wars such as Syria, Iraq and Libya, for example, would be stopped immediately. So if you go onto the British Constitution Group website, you also find that this is really an exciting opportunity, space for 950 people to come together in order to share ideas and team up around reasserting the rule of law and restoring the British Constitution. So if you haven't visited the British Constitution Group website, perhaps you do that. And 500 people in one hall was a very special environment. That was Winchester in November. 950 in this facility would be really fantastic. So it's up to you. Pass it on.
Okay. Now we've been mentioning Glass-Steagall again recently because Donald Trump has mentioned it. Before he was elected, he mentioned it, and it continues to be mentioned. And the financial establishment getting more and more concerned about this. So this is the American Banker website, the headline saying banks are losing the political long game. And this is written by Rob Blackwell, their bureau chief, their Washington bureau chief, sorry. And he's saying that really they've got to look out for Glass-Steagall because it's potentially coming. Concerned that Donald Trump is rolling back the Dodd-Frank Act. And he's saying that there's a significant downside to what's going on, one that might not be clear to banks until it's too late. He's saying that getting rid of Dodd-Frank, which is what Trump seems to be doing at the moment, could lead to far more drastic consequences. Items like big bank breakups, higher capital requirements, and the restoration of the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial and investment banking, may ultimately be back on the agenda. Well, it is back on the agenda, as we've reported recently, and it should be more than just on the agenda very, very quickly, because and until it is, we're still under the thumb of these so-called too-big-to-fail banks.
Too-big-to-fail banks and control of the Bank of International Settlements, which is apparently unknown to our politicians. But of course, the lie of no money means that everywhere we look, there are problems. It doesn't matter whether it's in UK or overseas. Coming in on the military side here, this extraordinary headline, which came out of Sputnik, but there are quotes from US military sources embedded in the article. And the meat of it is massive problems with the availability of U.S. air assets. So this figure here, 53% of U.S. Navy aircraft are not airworthy. This is problems with maintenance, with spares, with all kinds of logistics support. And the bulk of this is coming about because they're saying there hasn't been enough money to run the budget. So the banks controlling money from nothing and controlling nations and every part of it.
This is an interesting situation because we've got the same parallels in this country. We don't have the money, we're told, and yet the government is borrowing more money every year. So the government spending is not reducing. Certainly in the United States, defense spending is way beyond anything that Britain could ever hope to have, and yet they've still got this situation. So the question I would like to know the answer to is, where is the money going? If they can't keep their aircraft flying, if we can't run a health service and an old age care system because there isn't enough money, and yet governments are borrowing more money than they ever have in history, where is the money going? What's it being used for?
Well, I think it's being used for criminal activity and black ops, Mike. Is if we go to America, that's where vast amounts of money are going. And how is that possible? Because, of course, you've got massive corruption in the public services that ought to be accounting for that money. The same thing's happening here.
OK, well, let's talk about Douglas Chapman MP, who's a Scottish National Party MP in Scotland, obviously. And he was describing shipbuilding, naval shipbuilding in the UK. And he was talking about Queen Elizabeth class carriers, that the carriers, largest ships ever built by the Royal Navy, are being built on time and on budget in his constituency. So well done for that. Superb workforce is how he described it at the Rosyth dockyard. He said it would be a great disappointment to these men and women. This was in a debate in Westminster Hall yesterday. It would be a great disappointment to these men and women if the ships they have crafted are not adequately protected. And of course, he's referring to the fact that that they're not getting any kind of protection, missiles, any surface.
Surface missiles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he said that by the end of the, but he made the point that by the end of the Falklands conflict, there were 50 destroyers and frigates in the Navy. Even in the 1998 Strategic Defence Strategy Review, he said, long after the Cold War had ended, a floor of 32 was envisaged. Yet this is a government which crows about its commitment to 19 frigates and destroyers. It's quite incredible to think that in 2017, we're still to see a signed contract to begin replacing this Cold War platform. No one I've spoken to through my work in the Defence Select Committee, members, academics, shipbuilders, trade unions, and even civil servants, sees this as an acceptable, as in any way acceptable, yet here we are. And he also made the point that by 2021, the UK will not have built a single frigate in 20 years.
And the other point about this, Mike, is if the frigates or the ships are not being built, there's no spin-off industry going on around that. Everything around the shipbuilding arena is stagnated or disappeared. And, of course, you can see that very much in Plymouth. Plymouth used to be ringed by factories, a lot of which were there because of the work going on in the dockyard in Devonport. Dockyard virtually collapsed, a vacant 360-hectare site with almost no military activity, but all the factories have gone. Mm-hmm. Well, while the Navy is decaying, the top brass are busy overseas telling the Americans how good it is. Now, this is going back to October 2016, but Philip Jones, the first Sea Lord, was in Washington, D.C., and as part of his address to that American audience, he said today, the UK's national security is indivisible from that of continental Europe. The recent decision to leave the European Union does not change that. So here we have another senior military man simply saying there is no Brexit. There is no Brexit. Theresa May lying to the British public, saying that there is going to be a break with Europe. But the reality is that Britain's armed forces, including the nuclear deterrent, are being locked into the European Union system. So while the Admiral has been whining and dining with the Americans, we've just reminded him, because presumably he doesn't know, this is the report from the Sunday Times we've shown before. It's a shambles, problems with the latest world-beating Type 45 destroyers, problems with the Type 26 destroyers, problems with army equipment, and we're unable to build quiet warships anymore. Mm. Very significant if Russian submarines are such a threat that the government says it is. So we just say, shouldn't the First Sea Lord be tackling his creaking fleet? But no, he's overseas spending money saying how well we did at the Battle of Trafalgar. I believe we had more ships at the Battle of Trafalgar, Mike, and they seem to operate in warm water.
Yes.
Amazing. Well, let's bring in, this is a former First Sea Lord, Admiral Sir Mark Stanhope. And he said it was a decision made collectively that it be the Tornado that we keep and the Harrier that went. And as a result of that absolutely crass decision, of course, we've got no aircraft carriers and no working aircraft. And it's looking very interesting as to whether we're going to get the American F-35 because of cost overruns in that program. So we just remind people that behind the scenes, going back here to 2010, utter deceit as Britain's strategic defence review was conducted behind closed doors with French and British military politicians, Gisela Stewart MP there, all assisted by the Franco-British Council. So Brexit, it's a lie because we have full military integration with the European Union continuing as we speak.
Now, justice, so-called justice in this country, run by the Ministry of Justice, of course. When it comes to prisons and so on, we have HM Prison Service on one hand, and we also have the National Offender Management Service, which is probation, on the other hand. At least that's how it has been up until now. But in fact, the government has announced yesterday that basically they're going to burn that lot and replace it with the, here it is, Prison and Probation Service. So we're going to get rid of two specialised units and replace them with a new agency called the Prison and Probation Service. Liz Truss thinks it's fantastic. So let's see what she had to say. She said the new and operationally focused frontline service will implement the reforms we've announced to make our prisons safe and cut reoffending. She said our prison and probation officers do a vital job and they deserve to work in a world-class organisation which supports them in reforming offenders and keeping it the public safe. So this all sounds fantastic. Creating HMPPS will bring clarity to managing our prisons and probation service while further professionalising staff and building pride in their work. So they're going to professionalise staff that have been doing a professional job
This is an incredible insult, like, to somebody who's been a prison warder for however many, a career, and knows how to do their job. She's bringing in people who are largely lesser trained, but they're the professional ones, and you've been a civil servant doing your best for 20, 25 years. Well, you can go. This is a lie. It's distortion of the truth. And of course, what they're going to do is privatise the prison service completely.
That's right. That I believe is exactly what. So she's describing it as a specialist agency. She's going to professionalise the staff that have been doing a professional job for decades. And what I believe this is common purpose type language at work here. In this case, professionalising staff means privatising jobs.
Privatising. And we know from speaking to people in the probation service that there's utter chaos at the moment. People who should be, for example, looking after eight prisoners, they're expected to know the people personally. They're supposed to know what their training routine is. They're supposed to know the risks associated to any ex-offenders. They're now being asked to look after 20 or even 30 different prisoners at one time. So people are now leaving the service. People are taking time off work with stress. And all the reports made direct to the UK column on this subject is utter chaos. This is created chaos, of course, Mike.
Yes.
OK, well, let's move on to local authorities. Local authorities have got no money, but they're also doing some very interesting things. And we were alerted to the tree felling in Sheffield a few weeks ago, but we weren't able to pick it up then. But we're going to do it now because on the internet is really some astonishing and really excellent film footage as to what's been going on. Sheffield has decided to improve the city and improve roads. They're going to cut down mature and very beautiful trees. We've got some in the picture. Notices, of course, went up on these trees. And as we're going to see in a minute, teams of police turned up to support the workforce as these trees were simply felled. So we've got every local authority in the land supporting the environment, saving the world, looking after plant life and those, what are they, crested newts, I think they're very big on. We can't build buildings because of crested newts, but in Sheffield, they can come along and simply cut down the trees. Now, in this the video, and I do encourage you to go and have a look at it, the comments from local people, just amazing. This lady said there were the place was swarming with police. They took away two ladies in their 70s. Do we look intimidating? We've just been rendered powerless. And the police and the council workers turned up at 5 o'clock in the morning with big arc lights so that they could get those trees cut down before the residents were awake and really knew what was going on. This man was almost in tears. They asked him if he'd had a look at the fall, felled trees, and he said, I can't really look at it anymore. It's just too emotional. He was absolutely devastated. Now, we did speak to Sheffield City Council and asked what their media response on this was. They said they have made a media statement. There has been an apology by the leader of the council. We weren't able to get that in time for the programme.
Did they say what he was actually apologising for?
They were apologising for the fact that the police had turned up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I mean, this was like a terrorist raid. So presumably they're going to be doing this for seagulls, Mike. I would imagine we're going to be seeing armed terror police on Plymouth seafront to deal with those seagulls that we reported yesterday. If anybody's new to the programme and thinks we're sort of joking about that subject, terror seagulls resulted in a one-hour debate in a committee room in Westminster. Now, what we'd like to say is, of course, Sheffield boasts of its governance. Here's the documentation. It's focused on the purpose of the council and outcomes for local people, creating and implementing a vision for the city, promoting the values of the council and demonstrating these through high standards of conduct and behaviour, informed, transparent decisions, words and sentence after sentence. What a wonderful council. But we've been looking at this council for a very long time because this is a thoroughly common purpose trained council, and the words creep in when you know where to look at them. Now, if we follow this through from CP Expo's website, there is a vast amount of documentation on corruption in Sheffield City Council. This is one letter from a gentleman called Martin Brighton going back to the 1st of April 2009. The letter from John Mothersole, chief executive, dated the 17th of March 2009, further confirms the corruption that is, quote, rife throughout Sheffield City Council, led from the top down and out of control. And of course, if you have a totally corrupt council, then it is going to do as it pleases. So we'd like to say, welcome to life in a common purpose trained council. Cheating when dealing with complaints. The letter goes on to explain how any complaints to the council are simply shut down, ignored, dismissed. And very often that is done by the very same person who's the centre of the complaint. Now, we know the reliability of the person who's compiled this information. It's meticulously backed with evidence. And indeed, Mr. Brighton has now been a campaigner on the trail of corruption in Plymouth City, Freudian slip in Sheffield City Council for many years. So we'd encourage you to go to cpexposed.com and have a look at this. Now, this is the meat of it. This is what he says about common purpose. It's necessary here to describe some aspects of the practices of common purpose and how association with common purpose is integral to the corruption in this council. And one of the things that's pointed out is that John Mothersole said to the Audit Commission that common purpose was good for promoting the city, yet the comment from Mr. Brighton is there's no promotion that could not be done without common purpose. So what is the value on public money to having common purpose involved where there isn't any? But common purpose won't care because they specialise in hoovering up public money. But this is the meat of it. When common purpose can train organisations, these are some of the attributes that appear. We know because of reports from people who've lived in common purpose trained organizations, secretive, the lies, egos, arrogance, controlling. And of course, the paedophile aspect is that people warned of paedophiles being in the secretive common purpose networks. No notice was taken of that. And Matthew Byrne in the Liverpool area was on their advisory group board recruiting people into common purpose. He was convicted and sentenced for some utterly vile paedophile offences. So how does this organisation work? It infiltrates basically every part of a city it can get into. And the areas listed there were the respective areas that Common Purpose was using in Plymouth. And this model, of course, was mapped across to Sheffield. But to come in a slightly different, from a different angle, here's Leeds. This is a Leeds Common Purpose meeting going back to, 2006 on that. Have a look at the names and see the organisations that are brought together, top of which is Jeff Dodd, the Divisional Commander, Chief Superintendent, West Yorkshire Police. So we have police, the local newspaper, the university, and then we have local authorities, Common Purpose, and some of the NGO sectors. Why are we interested in this? Well, have a look at what was said. This is the key meet. Claire went through the advisory briefing pack and reiterated that they're not a board, but, quote, the eyes and ears of Common Purpose. So what business is it, Micah, this political charity, to be using senior police officers as their eyes and ears?
Well, this is a very good question. What they're saying is that Common Purpose is almost operating like an intelligence gathering organization. And if you have the chief constable at a meeting like that,
he's compromised.
He's not only compromised, but how do you know what he's saying? Because, of course, everything that the advisory group does, everything that Common Purpose does, their meetings are all held under Chatham House rules. Which means that nothing can be attributed to any member of the meeting. So he could be spilling his guts on a host of different subjects, and the public has no way of knowing.
That's absolutely correct. So we'll just add in here, why is this organisation so dangerous? Well, of course, they were behind the attempt of Leveson to control the mainstream press and media. And it's taken the UK column and this excellent article by Martin Edwards to warn of of Common Purpose within the NHS, where, of course, we now see bullying management and massive breakdown inside the NHS itself. We're going to be doing more on this subject over the coming days. But to end on a positive note, if you'd like to join others who are now standing up to say no more, then do come along to this event in Nottingham. On the 22nd of April, British Constitution Group, we can have nearly 1,000 people together in one place, which I think will be absolutely fantastic. So that's it for today. Thank you for joining us. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.